In the feed side, we involved, experts from academia, experts from government, as well as industry, to be around the table to really discuss what were the outputs of our literature reviews and what were some things that were applicable to the Canadian context.
We want to thank the innovative companies and products whose support and trust make this podcast possible. Evonik. We are sciencing the Global Food Challenge. Best Mix's industry-specific software supports feed and pet food producers in their daily challenges. Focus on your core job and let Best Mix do the rest.
Welcome to the Feed Science Podcast. I'm Dr. Adam Fahrenholz from North Carolina State University's Animal Food Manufacturing Program. Thank you for joining us today. And on behalf of Wisenetics, I would like to introduce today's guest. Our guest is Dr. Virginie LaChapelle. She is a veterinary science specialist in the Risk Assessment Models team as part of the Animal Health Science Directorate with the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. So today we get a little bit of north of the border perspective on things related to how things are regulated in the feed industry. Dr. LaChapelle, thank you very much for joining us.
Thank you very much for this invitation. Very happy to be here.
If you wouldn't mind, introduce yourself a little bit to our audience, a little bit of your background and how you came to be what you're doing today, and then you know what that is, what your role is there at the CFIA.
Yeah, sounds good. So, as you mentioned, I'm a veterinarian, graduated in 2011 at the University of Montreal here in Canada, and then did my PhD in veterinary sciences, specialized in microbiology at the same university, and had the opportunity actually to do a postdoctoral fellowship in science policy at the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. So started at the CFIA in 2018, and actually started with the project that I'm still on, which is developing risk assessment tools, more specifically to the feed sector. But our team, and I've been also involved with some of my colleagues on developing these similar types of tools for the food sector, as well as hatchery sectors, as we're really going through a modernization, regulatory modernization here in Canada, which started, with food and followed by hatcheries, and very, very recently in the feed sector as well. So responding to those needs for our decision makers to really allocate our inspection resources based on risks. So that's been sort of my main role, but I also am involved in academia activities, being an adjunct professor at the University of Montreal in the Department of Pathology and Microbiology. So doing a bit of teaching and a bit of research activities as well.
Excellent. Excellent. So when we talk about risk assessment in the animal food world and in the feed industry, what are the kind of most driving things for your agency when we look at risk and the risks that we're trying to mitigate? So if you're doing risk assessment, obviously there are some targets there. What are some of the primary targets we're talking about?
Yeah, so there's different types of risk assessments. So you can do like product-based risk assessments or activity-based. In our case, we're really focused on facility-based risk assessment. So we're really trying to assess what is the level of risk of each of our regulated establishment, and in order to sort of classify them and to prioritize our resources. So either inspection, preventive inspections, sampling activities, or other types of activities conducted at the CFIA to really prioritize those based on risks. So obviously, as part of that risk assessment, we are interested in the activities that are conducted in the establishment, the type of products, some mitigation strategies that they've implemented as well. And there's a big component as well on the compliance history based on our internal databases. So how we actually figure out what we want to consider or not is really we're trying to do a very scientific and standardized approach, which is very similar to the other risk assessment tools that we've developed. So it all actually started back in 2012, when in the food sector, they tried to see what was being done in food safety risk assessment. So they did sort of an international benchmarking to see what some of our trade partners were doing in their own regulatory framework. So basically, they saw some interesting ideas in terms of risk assessment. You usually try to have a metric, right, that is objective and that you can actually compare establishments based on that objective measurement, which was easy on the food safety perspective because they have DALYs, for example, which is that disability adjustment life years where you can really assess the burden for in terms of disease and mortality related to food safety concerns, which is a challenge that we're facing. We're integrating, obviously, feed safety considerations. But basically, they have that metric. They had ideas in terms of, well, we're considering, you know, these types of activities. There are compliance information, but they didn't really at the time have that mitigation perspective. When talking to our own industry, we saw that there were a lot of things that were being done to do things right. Because, for example, they know that their inherent risk is high because, for example, they're grounding meat versus, processing whole fruits. So obviously some of that inherent baseline level of risk is very much known, but there are things that they can do to mitigate that. So those are sort of the main principles of the risk assessment approach was done through that benchmarking exercise, obviously, as well, some literature reviews. And what we did as well in parallel in each of our tools is to involve experts. So have expert consultations, so involving Canadian experts in their respective fields. So in the feed side, we involved, experts from academia, experts from government, as well as industry. To be around the table to really discuss what were the outputs of our literature reviews and what were some things that were applicable to the Canadian context, because obviously we're really trying to stay in that specific framework. So basically that were really those initial steps where we wanted to assess, okay, so how can we discriminate the level of risk of an establishment based on, you know, the type of activity and products. And obviously we want to discriminate. So if it's a practice that is known at risk, but that everybody, you know, is doing within the industry, it's not something that we're interested in trying to discriminate that level of risk between establishments. And for example, we do want, you know, factors in our risk assessment that we can be measurable. So for example, there were some discussions in terms of should we consider, the speed of production lines as being at risk. What is a good speed? What is too high? What is too low? Right? If some type of products are considered as risk, like for example, soy-based products. Such a majority of mills, for example, that would be dealing with these ingredients, that's not really a fine-tuned discriminant factor. So there were a lot of discussions around that. So it's nice to have the science, but how is that applicable to our industry, right? And same thing for the mitigation measures, like what is our industry doing to, limit cross-contamination risks, to, control their incoming supplies? Do they have letters of guarantees that they can use? Do you have certificates of analysis? Do some, parties do on-site audit of their suppliers? Do we have feed safety certifications that we can try to recognize and so forth? And obviously, our compliance component is really much related to our new regulations. So we're really trying to align with although at the time when we started to develop the feed tools, we didn't have actually our regulatory package that was formally published, we knew that we were, leaning towards that preventive inspection approach, where we know that, there is some elements of that standard inspection approach across sectors that was going to be implemented. So it's really sort of that whole development is based on a scientific approach where we used, literature reviews, expert consultations, but then, you have to confirm if your model is actually accurate. So we did, pilot projects and data collection processes to see if, you know, our regulated parties saw themselves as part of that data collection, if there's some practices, additional practices that we didn't think of that we should consider as well. And it's really a dynamic type of process in which, because industry is evolving, risks are evolving as well. We have sometimes emerging hazards that emerge through the years, basically. So we need to reconduct that exercise in time. So, but for now, we're really on the feed side. We've really just developed and recently launched on in our commercial feed mill industry, more specifically.
That's a great, great background. You said something in there I wanted to touch a little bit more on it. And you talked about, went and did the literature reviews, went and looked at, you know, the information that you had, you know, that already existed, knowing about what facilities are doing and what products they're creating, what markets they're going to, and all these sorts of things. And then you go and you start talking about the practices. Well, one of the discussions we've had with a number of manufacturers and facilities and companies here in the U.S. and some of the folks that we work closely with is that idea of, yes, you've probably been doing a good job of a lot of these preventive kinds of things for a very long time. It's you know, it's part of the ethical responsibility. It's good business practice anyway. Everybody wants to do a good job. But one of the issues when we actually start doing a risk assessment approach is actually having the data. And it's, you can't do the risk assessment with some sort of, you know, basis at some point in effectively mathematics and statistics. You can't do that without data and numbers. And we can't do that without actually having information of how many samples are you collecting? You know, how many of that is that per versus what you thought you were trying to collect based on what the operators did? How many days did you do this versus not do this? This kind of stuff. And so I know we've had conversations with folks about sometimes when there's a frustration in being questioned on whether or not their actions are enough. It's not necessarily that anybody's saying your actions aren't enough. It's that we don't have the data enabled to be able to prove it. So I was wondering if you might talk a little bit about that, about what the process has been like as you've tried to do these pilot projects to get facilities to understand that to do this, they're probably going to have to do more data collection on their activities than they have in the past.
Yeah, that's a good question. I think data collection, data management, data quality, data sharing is a big conversation in the big data world that we're in right now. It's so to answer your question in terms of data collection, so we've done a lot of outreach to industry for them to understand. So this is a voluntary process, just so to say. Although it guides some of our regulatory activities, we don't have, for up to now at least, the regulatory power to be collecting that data on our parties. However, I have to say that we have had a great participation rate in collecting the information that we need to from the industry perspective, I mean, to collect, because we need industry data, obviously, to feed our tool. And we've had a really, really great response. I think, especially like for now, we've approached the feed mill industry, most specifically commercial feed mill, also on-farm type feed mills, so that we were able to do that. But obviously, on the on-farm feed mill, there were some challenges because we don't necessarily have full lists of who are our party and how to reach out to them, because sometimes it's not, you know, as easy as just sending an email. So those are some challenges in that data collection, in which we're trying to use online tools which are automated, which decrease, you know, the risks of affecting our data quality as well as all the resources that represents. But basically, in terms of the data collection, we did a lot of info sessions. We really try to accompany a lot our regulated parties if they have some challenges in terms of being able to access our systems and provide the data. We can do that manual input, although it's not, you know, the pathway that we're really supporting. But I think they recognize, and we're trying to, you know, like if you give some of it of the data, I mean, it's a good way for us to report back to you on how you're doing. And we're also not only providing individual reports in terms of all their risk information and how, like, what are their risk results in that output, we're also providing national reports. So they can actually, you know, there's sort of a benefit that we're trying to put out there in terms of you can compare yourselves to your own industry and maybe improve what you're doing. But yeah, definitely some challenges there in terms of having the data collection. We've seen some other sectors in which it can be a lot more challenging, but I have to say that up to now in the feed sector, it's been much very good participation rate. The challenges that we have, obviously, as we're going as an agency through a digitization process, is getting like a fully automated process on our end to make sure that we are, you know, we give timely results, not only to our inspectorate, but also to our regulated parties to, you know, so that we can share back as soon as possible that information. So there's a lot of a back and forth as well in terms of we're almost like a service, which is not quite typical, I have to say, of the branch that I'm in. Our team is easily accessible. And, you know, some parties sometimes have questioned, well, okay, if I see my report and I see that there are some mitigation measures that some of, you know, my competitors are implementing, and I wonder if I add those measures, would that impact my overall risk in the end? Like, should I be, you know, investing in these measures so that it affects my level of risk? So we can provide that input in terms of how can they improve, you know, their overall risk profile. Sometimes it's maybe because they have those recurrent, you know, issues on some compliance components. So sometimes it's, well, maybe going back to the inspector and working with your inspector and trying to improve what's happening in your establishment. So I think some of that participation came from, it's sort of a bilateral exchange of information. So there is somewhat of a benefit. And unfortunately, because we were not able to actually make this we're collecting information through a questionnaire, right? An online questionnaire. And that, as I mentioned, we can't make it mandatory, although we really want our parties to be filling it out because it really informs our program design and how we're attributing resources. So another aspect that might have supported the participation in collecting data is that if they are not providing that data, we are automatically attributing them a high risk, right? Because we don't know what's going on in that establishment, we're putting you in our high risk category. So, and usually that high risk category is an increased number of inspection frequencies. So, and you know, we don't want CFI inspectors coming too much for nothing, right? So it might have been an incentive to actually be providing that data. And then I could go into the data quality concerns, which is something we're trying to work hard on. But obviously now, as I mentioned, we're in sort of a somewhat manual process. We're looking towards a digitization process, which I hope will really support that data quality, because obviously if there's errors in that data coming in, you know, garbage in, garbage out, right? So there's also those other concerns that we're trying to tackle with.
So my guest today, again, is Dr. Virginie LaChapelle with the Canadian Food Inspecting Agency. We're talking about risk assessment and the tools that are being developed to determine risks in the animal food sector. I think it, one of the things you just talked about there that's very interesting is that idea of if there are going to be tools like this developed, then potentially the inspection agency can provide some service by providing feedback, which is good. But at the same time, the only way to do that is to give the data. And as you said, if you don't have the data that you need, then you have no choice but to say that we can't establish a risk for you. And so therefore it's I think that's, and it's something that's happened here as well, where some inspections have been based off of quote risk, and inspection frequency is based off of risk. And I think it's a hard thing to understand a little bit, where it's well, wait a minute, what do you mean you're assigning me a high risk? And it's kind of like, well, it's, we call you high risk because we don't have a category for like null risk, as in we have no idea what your risk is. And so people will respond negatively to that and be like, what do you mean I'm high risk? And it's like, well, it may not be necessarily that you are, quote, high risk in reality, but because we are not getting the information we need, we can't establish what your risk is. And then so you get into this real back and forth, right, about, well, why do you need all this information? And it's kind of like, well, we're trying to help you. And it's, well, oh, yes, the government's usually here to help me. And we get into all these debates, right? So I can certainly see how that's something that's difficult to deal with, and try to convince people that this is, you know, we really are trying to have this in your best interest, with the pushback then of, yes, but I only want to give you the information that I'm required to, because, you know, again, it's inspection and it's evidence and all these other things. So I think that's a really interesting concept for everybody on kind of both sides of that conversation to figure out where the other side's perspective is.
We do. So they're kind of in that category unassessed, right?
Yeah.
Just attributed that high frequency. Although we have to say that we're trying as much as possible to, you know, to get the information. We don't want it to be coming from our inspectors directly, because they know what the practices are being done, right, in the establishments that they're inspecting. But it, you know, legally and technically speaking, this is not information that, you know, inspectors own. So it should not come from them. And we are trying to, that's why we're trying as much as possible, you know, incentives to have them provide that information. And if it, you know, if it means that, you know, the inspector is, you know, sitting along that regulated party and filling it out manually, and that we input it manually, then so it be. But yeah, for sure, if it's a miscomprehension of what we'll be doing that with that information, which is protected B, obviously, this is like not information that we're sharing outside of our relationship with each regulated party. But yeah, for sure, it can come with, that's our main challenge, I have to say. Although we have had a very high participation rate, we've seen, for example, if I compare with the food sector, we have like a new sector which was previously not registered towards the CFIA, which is like the manufactured foods. So they're a new sector under CFIA oversight. They, you know, came in with the new regulations. They have no idea. They don't want to see CFIA. So we've seen challenges in some of these sectors which have no history of relationship with the CFIA in, you know, building a trust. I think that's something as well that needs to be put forward, is that all of this is based on trust towards the organization, sometimes directly with their CFI inspector. But yes, at the end of the day, it's their call, and it needs to be a good understanding from both parties. Yeah.
Yeah. The trust part is something that's always, you know, when we see in those inspector facility relationships, it's, you know, there are things where, you know, maybe the trust should be better than it is now, but it's still got a lot of history behind it, and
yeah,
people have to work
exactly
through that. Yeah, that's a whole nother set of conversations. One last question I wanted to ask you before we kind of get into a little bit of a wrap up here. And I don't want to put you on the spot, so if you can't answer, that's fine. But are there some things that come to mind off the top of your head as you've looked through and you guys have done this project of, you know, the top few things that are attributing to, let's call it, you know, feed safety risk right now?
Yeah, that's a good point. So what we've seen through all sectors were food, hatcheries, feed. We say feed more than animal food, I guess.
We're supposed to be trying to learn to say animal food here, because feed and pet food and all that. And for some of us, me included, trying to say, Yeah, for those of us that have kind of been around the quote feed industry all this time, it's still hard to not say feed all the time, because that's what I want to say. So we usually say like livestock feed, pet food, or if we're going to group it all together, animal food, sort of. But it's
Nope, that's interesting differences. Definitions are important. Just to come back to your question. So what we've seen, generally speaking, is that very few establishments actually contribute to most of the risk, right? So a vast majority of our establishments are really towards, you know, that medium or low risk. We have very few players. So usually what we've seen that drives most of the risk is either the volume of production, because obviously if you're distributing like 50% of, you know, of your sector in terms of products, if something goes wrong in your establishment, you know, you're more at risk of having like a lot of impact, right? Negative impact. So that risk exposition component that we refer to is really important. So the volume, and obviously sometimes that drives a lot of the risk is sort of bad history in terms of compliance and like recurrent bad history, because we don't just consider like the most recent inspection results. We actually go back up to the last 3 years. So sometimes if you have recurrent issues, obviously that sort of escalates your level of risk even higher, because obviously there's other factors that come into play, like, you know, prohibited materials while also manufacturing ruminant feed. So those are factors that come in. But in terms of what I've seen as most impactful is really that risk exposition component, and having like recurrent compliance issue is something that impacts a lot, because we have sometimes some players that don't have that much of a high volume, but because they, you know, haven't corrected some issues in time, that affects obviously the overall risk of that establishment, because we want to go some in a way of trying to go back and resolve that issue and trying to help out as well. I mean, it's supposed to be that relationship of trying to help and improve the processes that are in place, and not just, you know, enforcing. It's trying to resolve. So
yeah, that's excellent. That's that whole idea of, you know, of past performance being an indicator of future performance really holding true in this case from what you're seeing. Certainly the percentage of that, I mean, that just makes sense from the standpoint of even if you do a really, really good job, if you're 100% the supplier of this ingredient, the only risk in that ingredient can come from you, and there's just nothing, you know, statistically you can do about that. And, you know, and maybe there's just never been a problem, and that's great, but you're still going to be, you're still going to be, you know, responsible for all the risk. That's just how the numbers work out. And it is interesting. And I think we've seen a similar thing here in the US with the idea that it's typically few establishments that are really, you know, the majority of the risk is coming from. And again, I think that goes back to some of that hard conversation of, okay, well, if we know that, then, you know, can those of us that are the larger establishments that don't have that past history, a lot of problems, you know, why are we still have to be, you know, held? And it's, well, because there's a few that aren't. And if you're doing everything right, you have nothing to worry about. But don't you want to make sure that even your competitors are being held to the same standard that you are? And you don't want somebody out here giving, you know, your industry a bad name by not doing a good job. You're doing fine. And that becomes some really, those conversations become so tricky, because everybody gets, you know, it takes everything very personally on, you know, saying that, you know, they could potentially have a problem, or I have to be inspected, or whatever the case may be. But it is interesting that some of those things, hold true. And I think a lot of people in our industry would probably agree that those things have probably always held true, but it's good to actually have the numbers that go to it and say, yes, no, we can prove this. And once we can prove it, now we can do something about it, versus just its stories that are floating around.
For sure. And if I can just jump on that as a minor, like, precision, is that there's that overall level of risk that we can attribute with it's basically a mathematical algorithm, but another component, and although they may be always at high risk, because inherently, as you mentioned, like they have like 100% of the volume and all that, There's as well, like, because we consider different risk levels depending on the baseline level, then we, you know, including their mitigation measures, it can go down. And then with the compliance results, it can go back up if they have compliance issues. But we also consider, like, another parameter that our decision makers can use is sort of the delta of, well, their baseline, because of their volumes, their types of products, was, you know, I don't know, I'm saying anything like 20, a risk level of 20, but then they, you know, they mitigated their risk, they have good compliance history, so that brought them down to 10. Like, so they reduced by 2 times their level of risk. Although it's may be still high compared to others, they're in a good control of their feed safety risk. So there's that, we call it the delta of, like, the baseline versus, you know, adding the different levels of information and the overall result. So that is as well sort of a parameter, is for those, like, big establishments that, you know, have that high baseline level of risk, we can still have other parameters that if they're doing a good job, they could, you know, it could be recognized basically in that perspective. So there's a lot of things from that data that can come out of, but I completely agree that it all comes to that, you know, exchange of and that relationship between both parties.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yep. And that's one of the fun parts in some ways about, like, being in the academic side is, you know, we get to work with the industry, we get to work with the regulatory agencies, and we get to sit in the middle. And I mean, well, sometimes in academia, we get to be the problem too. But we get to sit in the middle a little bit and say, yeah, you know, there are times where, you know, the regulatory agency has created too much burden. And there are going to be people out there that are doing inspections that are going way too far in some of the stuff they're doing. And that needs to be addressed. And on the other side, are you certain, as, you know, a lot of times we're talking with the folks that are in charge of quality or something, but it's like, were you in the room when the person at your facility answered these questions? And are you sure that maybe they didn't say something that gave somebody pause? And you're upset because you think there's an overburden here, but based on what they heard, they've got good reason to be concerned, sort of a thing. And again, that's why I love projects like this, where it's like anything else in the world. It's like, if we can start assigning values and numbers and data, and generally speaking, those numbers, as long as the algorithms are correct and well tested and everything else, they don't have feelings. And so it's like, this is what this says, and you're basing other things off of emotions and who was having a bad day at that time and everything else, and who knows if that's the real story. But this actually gives me something to say where, you know, performance is adequate, where performance is great, where performance could be improved. And that's why I think these kinds of things are so valuable, because it can take the emotion out of it, which in a lot of cases drives some bad decision-making, we'll say.
It's time for our famous three. With its advanced industry-specific capabilities, Best Mix software empowers nutritionalists and formulators to optimize material allocation, manage recipes, and ensure data confidence for informed decision-making. By providing a comprehensive solution that integrates real-time data and strategic planning tools, Best Mix enables you to do the job efficiently and precisely. Focus on your core job and let Best Mix do the rest.
Well, I very much enjoyed our conversation. It's been great. One last thing I wanted to ask you about. We always do some kind of follow-up kind of questions that are a little off topic, but we'll have to do kind of with, you know, professional growth and things for those folks in our audience that are, you know, looking at where they might take their careers. You've got an interesting position in that you're obviously working a fair amount with the industry. You exist inside of a regulatory agency, but as you mentioned, you're also doing things academically. You obviously did as a student multiple times, DVM, PhD, and everything that would go into that. And now you've got this adjunct appointment where you're doing some as well. So the question I'm going to ask is, what are a thing or something that, as you look at people, and no matter where they're at, whether they're industry, academia, regulatory, world, but is a, you know, a personal or a professional characteristic of how they go about doing their business that translates across the board. And if you can make this a part of the way that you operate, you could be successful in any one of these realms.
A big last question. honestly, I had the opportunity of working, like I mentioned, because we're actively involved. I'm actively involved with academia, but even within my CFI position, as well as with industry. So looking at the exchanges with the different backgrounds, I feel like having a scientific curiosity and being very open is something, like, because of our project is really much, you know, supporting a change management, because, mm-hmm. you know, there's a change management for our own organization, for the industry throughout this project. I feel like you have to be, like, very open to hearing other perspectives and hearing and then acting on it, right? It's not just, I'm listening, but I'm actually just, like, you know, passively listening, not actually doing anything about it. I feel like that. And I might not have the great term to actually detail it, but I feel like having that, being very open and acting on what you're hearing gives you a lot of grounds and respect from your colleagues and to move forward. I think that is something that I've seen a lot.
I love the word curiosity in your answer. I think that's huge. I think it's huge in what we see in our students in academia. I think it's huge in industry. And it doesn't matter, you know, it's not, you don't have to be in, like, research development to be curious. You know, you can be an operator of a piece of equipment, but being curious about how it works and what if I made this small change, could it make it better? And just wanting to learn more about what you do and how you can, I think it's a massive underestimated quality in folks that just have that curiosity to want to go learn more about whatever it is. I think that's the perfect word. I think you had it right there in your answer.
Yeah, and it's definitely not diploma based, right? Because I've had a lot of these curious, you know, characters and very, very, like, interesting people that move forward, and that, you know, it's not academia based at all.
No, everybody can get to very successful places through a lot of different paths, and absolutely, and I agree with you 100%. You know, as someone who's sitting here, you know, with multiple degrees and in education, and obviously has a, you know, I see a value in a higher education and everything else. And I'm going to tell you, there's lots of people that we work with in the industry that are self-made successes that if they had wanted to, they could have come breezed through a doctorate somewhere, because mm-hmm. they've got the curiosity and the brain power and the work ethic to do it. They just took a different path to get there.
There's exactly,
you know, yeah, neither one is better. They're just different paths to get to some end point. So 100% right there with you. Well, I very much agreed, or very much enjoyed, rather, our conversation, and have agreed with a lot of it as well. We're going to go through the full title here one more time. My guest has been Dr. Virginie LaChapelle. She is the veterinary science specialist on the Risk Assessment Models team with the Animal Health Science Directorate in the Canadian Food Inspection Agency. I always have to look down to read all that. It's quite a title. Business card must be quite long.
Kudos for your French.
Yeah, yep, absolutely. I've really enjoyed it. Thanks a lot for joining us today.
Thanks to you.
Once again, my name is Adam Farinholz, coming to you from North Carolina State University. On behalf of Wisenetics, this has been the Feed Science Podcast. Thanks for listening, and we will talk to you the next time.
Do you feel overwhelmed with mundane tasks that eat up your valuable time? It's time to reclaim your schedule and focus on what truly matters. Get your time back with elite remote talent from Brazil without the time zone hassle. Delegate $10 an hour tasks to focus on more $1,000 an hour tasks. Schedule your free strategy call at wisevas.io.